You're listening to the World Affairs Podcast, bringing you new perspectives, global stories, and conversations that matter. I'm Jane Wales. Many stories caught our attention in 2015. One in particular will surely stay with us long into the new year and beyond, and that's the crisis of migration and refugees. The number of forcibly displaced people has reached 60 million. That's the highest level since World War II, and the numbers continue to rise. At World Affairs, we heard from many speakers on the crises of the civil war in Syria, of endemic poverty elsewhere, of state failure, and the resulting displacement of the innocent. This migrant crisis, it's shaking the world. In this episode, we'll hear from seven individuals. Each had a different perspective, but they shared a sense of alarm, a sense of urgency, and of compassion for those affected by this ongoing crisis. We'll begin with Filippo Grandi. When he spoke to us, he had just been appointed UN High Commissioner for Refugees.
The war in Syria, unlike what is often portrayed, is not a war with clear front line and clear lines of command, either on the government and on the opposition side. It's a very messy war where front lines change every day. That's very dangerous, as you can imagine, because you don't know where you are and with whom you have to deal with. And the lines of command are very, very arbitrary and volatile. So you may get permission to access an area, and the next day that permission may not be there anymore, or you may be in an area where you're not allowed to be. There's a lot of kidnappings on both sides. There is a lot of trading of hostages. It is, you know, I've been involved in my career in a lot of rather messy situations, but this is now up there or down there with the worst of the past 20 years, with Central Africa, with the Balkans. And it is astonishing that this has happened in a country that, whatever its problems, was, as I said, relatively stable for a very long period of time. It is important to remember that the Syria crisis, which is perhaps today, surely today, the most acute emergency, political, humanitarian, strategic emergency in the world, that emergency has a lot of different dimensions.
The testimony you should hear is not just mine, it's from Syrians themselves. And what Syrians will tell you, Syrian civilians who we are helping in the neighboring countries, the four neighboring countries have had this influx of about 3 million refugees. That's Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, and Iraq. But also Syrians inside the country, some of them in besieged cities, some of them closer to the border, so easier to reach with cross-border operations. What those Syrians say is very simple. They say, does anyone care? Because the scale of the loss of life, the scale of the destruction, 40% of hospitals ruined beyond repair, the scale of the abuse of the most basic rights. I mean, who would have thought in the 21st century we'd be discussing what to do about a government that drops barrel bombs on the houses of its own people? It's little wonder that Syrians are saying, does the world care? And what they're saying in that comment is, there's a collective failure here of very significant proportions, that those phrases never again seem to stick in their gullets, because what they are seeing is not just a war without end, but a war without law as well. And so I think the stakes are very high, not just for those who are in the firing line, the Syrians themselves, the neighboring countries that are under such huge duress, but the humanitarian system as a whole, because our assumptions, our norms, our practices are being stretched by this extraordinary crisis. What I think is really important that people understand is that when you conjure up the notion of a displaced person or a refugee, the immediate thought is it's someone who's incredibly poor. The people that we're talking about here are effectively middle-class people. I mean, they're educated people, they've got jobs as business people, they're teachers, they're every conceivable aspect of modern life, because Syria and Iraq have been modern societies. And what you're seeing, therefore, is that when 500,000 people get displaced, for the first 3 or 4 weeks, they have the savings, they have the connections, they're able to contain the damage. But what we're going to see over the next period is people run out of their savings, of people relying on neighbors but not being able to rely on them anymore, of relatives or friends. And that's when the humanitarian agencies come into their own, or need to come into their own, with the basics of shelter and food. We don't actually, IRC doesn't do much food distribution, but health systems, overburdened education systems, kids without education is obviously a huge problem for the future. And this bind of the protection challenge alongside the economic challenge is often not getting the attention it deserves.
That was David Miliband. He's CEO of the International Rescue Committee. And although he shared these thoughts over a year ago, they're still true today. The Syrian civil war poses a vast humanitarian crisis. It's one that calls for smart policy, both to stop the war and address its terrible effects. Vali Nasser served in the State Department, and he's now dean of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He bemoans what he feels is the lack of a clear and coherent policy when it comes to Syria. See what you think.
We usually think of refugees as sort of an afterthought to the strategic issues we're dealing with. So at least a third of Syria's 21 million population has been displaced. And that's a really huge number. And it has, you can think about what it means for 7 million people to be homeless, to be without a proper economy, for their children basically to be left to their own devices in refugee camps. A recent number was that the number of Syrian kids that need schooling in refugee camps is equivalent to the entire population of the state of Maryland. That's the size of the, and if you don't give them education, you're just basically growing a generation of displaced, alienated, uneducated youth with no hope in the future. It doesn't take a brain surgeon to know what direction they might be moving and what it means for the region. But also, Syria's refugee problem is destabilizing to the rest of the region. So about a size of the Syrian refugees in Jordan is now equivalent to 25% of Jordan's population. In fact, the largest refugee camp in Jordan would be that country's fourth largest city in just terms of the size of that refugee camp. In Lebanon, the number of refugees that have gone there who tend to be all Sunni is actually changing the sectarian balance in Lebanon, which could, cause a conflagration over there. Now, the international community is not doing much about the refugees, basically. What the assistance that's coming is fairly paltry compared to what is needed. But what is actually needed most of all is a ceasefire in Syria. I mean, refugees won't go back, can't go back, until, first of all, the fighting stops, and also areas that is under the control of either Al-Qaeda forces or ISIS is cleared out, then the question becomes, how do you get to a ceasefire, right? So actually that needs some kind of a political process equivalent to what was in the Balkans or in other conflicts, which currently doesn't exist really. And secondly, who's going to clear out ISIS out of these areas so people can go back? And then, Syria is not a rich country, and large parts of this country has been completely devastated. People compare Syrian cities in the way they look to European cities after World War II. So, there was a Marshall Plan that rebuilt Europe, and that's an open question, too, about who's going to be paying for rebuilding of Syria going forward. But the problem is there is no Syria policy. There is no serious strategy. It actually doesn't exist. If you actually asked, and many people in the region do, so what is the strategy for Syria? And the simple answer is that there isn't one.
We may say that we have been able to keep our promise, which has been stated in Charter of the United Nations, to save succeeding generations from scourge of war. That we have done, but there is no guarantee. But there have been genocide in 1994 in Rwanda, 1995, just 20 years ago, in Srebrenica, there were hundreds of thousands of people were killed. That we committed that we there should be never again. But this never again commitment has been broken, unfortunately. We are in the fifth year of a devastating conflict in Syria that continues to worsen. Humanitarian suffering in Yemen is affecting millions of people. We have not been able to have a good solution yet. We are still working. South Sudan, the world's youngest country, is suffering from 18 months of civil war. More than 4.5 million people are severely food insecure. These and other conflicts along the poverty has driven 60 million people internally displaced and refugees. That's a serious issue. United Nations is working hard to address these challenges.
We also heard from United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. With a crisis of this scale, different actors play different roles, of course. So here's Yves Dacour. He's Director General of the International Committee of the Red Cross. He speaks of his organization's role.
Can I just give you a sense of what is happening right now in Syria and what does that mean also for us in terms of response? First, when we talk about the response of the Red Cross, Red Crescent, you have to talk about our response, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and the Red Crescent, right? The Syrian Arab Red Crescent, which is a very important players. When we talk about the people who died, they were all volunteers of the Red Crescent. And they all died and in a very difficult situation of conflict. It tells you something in terms of violence. We never had, since the Second World War, that many people from the Red Cross, Red Crescent killed. It tells you it's a very strong figures about what is happening in right now in Syria and the level of violence we're going through. In terms of response, what we're trying to do is, of course, we're trying to make sure that there is an understanding on all the sides, on what we call the party to the conflict, about what is our role and responsibility, trying to make sure that they will respect us. And here, let's be clear, it's not something we can declare from Geneva or even from San Francisco. You have to deal and demonstrate that and deal with that every day. You do have to negotiate, you know, face to face with everybody on a daily basis. And this is what happens in Syria. It's extremely difficult, but we have not found any better way to manage on a daily basis access, acceptance, than to discuss with the people, including the most difficult groups, including the most difficult group. That's what we do on a daily basis. And it's a very long-term work, and it's sometimes extraordinarily difficult. Still today in Syria, there are areas which are out of reach for us, where we cannot reach because it's too dangerous, because we don't receive the security guarantee. There are other parts of Syria where we can work, where we can, on a daily basis, make some cross line, but Syria today remains an extremely difficult area for us to work.
The scope of the Syrian war has created a crisis that extends well beyond the region. As the displaced arrive in Europe, often after harrowing experiences, they find a continent that's just unprepared. The existing systems are overwhelmed. And political consensus over what to do has proved elusive. Elisa Massimino is president and CEO of Human Rights First. She described the situation in Europe.
The pre-existing condition in Europe was this sense of, you know, a failure to adequately integrate immigrants and other minorities into society, sense of marginalization there, which exacerbated the sense of injustice and, you know, makes it easier to recruit people to a more extremist view. You know, obviously the economic situation has made it much more difficult for the ruling parties to deal with immigration in a humane way. And all of that is happening at a time, you know, when, because of the war in Syria and lots of other crises, right now there are more migrants and refugees than any time since World War II. I mean, it is a massive global crisis. And the global system of refugee protection that was developed mostly after World War II is falling apart, and you know, and Western nations are not doing what they have committed to do, and obviously Europe is a destination for a lot of these people. And now, you know, there are countries in Europe that have done an awful lot and have done a pretty good job. I mean, Italy has certainly taken in a lot. But the overall response has not been great. People who are desperate, who are fleeing persecution and threat, I mean, imagine yourself in that situation. You'll do whatever you can do. And people find a way. You know, the one thing I think the EU is considering is upping its, you know, numbers of refugees that it would resettle, which is obviously really important. But the numbers they're talking about, around 20,000 extra slots, is not, it's kind of a drop in the bucket. But certainly it's a step in the right direction, and we would welcome that. You know, but there need to be legal routes for migration. And countries have never been very good at that.
This is about policy, it's about systems, it's about politics and culture, but at the heart it's about people, their means of coping, their resilience, their fears. I spoke with Nancy Lindberg. She's president of the U.S. Institute for Peace. I asked her about the individuals who've been uprooted and how this painful experience might shape them and shape their children. How refugees, particularly the Syrians, how can they maintain dignity in a situation like this as they go into Europe? You know, there are Greek citizens out there rescuing the drowning, but at the same time, you've got the Hungarian government putting up a fence. You've got a lot of tens of thousands of people basically in a no man's land, not welcome. What is the effect on their psyche? How can they maintain some level of dignity, and how will it make it think about their own role as either Europeans or if they're back home?
That is a really important question, because it goes to the heart of how we respond to people who are displaced and people who are refugees. When I was in northern Iraq, I was talking to a civil society activist who said, you know, we have 7 refugee camps in Erbil, a city in northern Iraq. So that means we have 7 time bombs. Hmm. Why? Because most of the children are not in school. Many of the people are dealing with deep, deep trauma. Most of them can't find work. And one of the realities of host countries is that many of them have official policies that prohibit people from working as a refugee. Yeah. Okay. And so deprived of work often means you are utterly deprived of dignity. And that there's a clear correlation to a rise of domestic violence that occurs. Mm-hmm. Among refugee populations. Often the only way they can make a living is their kids. If there is school, they have to pull them out. One of the issues that I'm really struck by is there are, I think the figure is in the neighborhood of 12 million children in the Middle East who are displaced and out of school. And the likelihood of refugee children actually getting to school is very low. It's somewhere in the 50% range. This is huge. Mm-hmm. This is huge that you have so many children in that region, out of school, feeling hopeless, no future to fasten to. This is a cauldron. This is a recruiting opportunity of great mm-hmm. potential. Mm-hmm. And so I think at our peril, don't look more closely at the kind of assistance that really focuses on how to help kids get back into school, how to help people make a living, how to provide assistance that is fundamentally about enabling people to maintain their dignity. And one final thing, because I'm really taken about this, the research on what is the impact on children under 5 on their brain development mm-hmm. when they are in toxic environments with stress, with conflict, with social exclusion. And it's almost as potent as the deprivation from malnutrition yep. and micronutrients. So you have a generation growing up now in that part of the world, And, you know, you want to talk to the leaders and say, do you know that you're depriving your country of a future? Mm-hmm. Not to mention, you know, the 50 years of development gains that Syria has lost, but the future gains that it is mortgaging.
In the months and years ahead, the world will continue to face this refugee crisis. Policy debates will continue, and the systems we have in place will be strained. The effects will be lasting. The same can be said for those most affected. The refugees and migrants have lost so much. Some have lost family members. All have left the lives they've left behind. But most of all, they will have lost that reassuring sense of being at home. At World Affairs, we will continue to follow this story as it unfolds. We'll bring you new perspectives, global stories, and conversations that matter. Visit worldaffairs.org to find the full recordings of our events with the speakers that we've just featured in this episode. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for listening.